Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm the control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been going strong for over 44 years. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we all gather together in front of our radios, and we chat, we exchange information, we learn from each other, we teach each other, and we entertain each other. And I thank you once again for coming back here this Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. Let me drop for a second, and I will give you the usual link. Okay, if you want to reach me by email, that would be either for mailbag questions. Those are questions normally asked on the technical net, but if you're not in radio contact, you can email it to me, and if it sounds interesting, we can discuss it. You can listen to it over the internet audio stream that's available live, or you could go to where it's stockpiled and archived and pull the pull down and listen to it at your leisure. Also, if some technology has come into the news and you are aware of it and understand it better than us and would like to share expertise, you can contact me and say that, you know, you would like to talk a little bit about such and such technology. We can arrange that. Or if you have a question about something space or NASA related and want to relay it to Paul, to Mr. Webb, of course, you can directly contact him. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. The other link is I cut and paste a bunch of interesting articles in YouTube during the week and put them up on a page, and at your convenience, you can get it by just typing into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you my link page, and you can review the articles at your leisure. We have a chat room. It's been rather quiet lately. You can get to it by typing into your browser chat.ac2gs.com. And, of course, I always like to remind people that MikeKC2NJI has an archive site. It's called AmateurRadio.tv, and he's archived Limark Technical Nets as far back as September 2006. Please check out. Those are the usual links. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you what we got planned. Okay. In honor of the 80th anniversary of D-Day, I have a TechNet, a little TechNet micro puzzle that's related to World War II and the manufacture of quartz crystals for radio that I found rather interesting. And so I'll tell you a little story about that and ask you a little question about some technical aspect of it and see who knows what. That's sometime in the midst of our first segment, which is going to be questions and topics for discussion and comments and what have you. I'll ask people if they have any. Preferably, the first few people should have questions or topics related to amateur radio, but as we all know, we're open to any kind of science and technology as the night progresses. If you have questions of other science and or technology, we'll try and address it as best we can. To take us to about 15, US2S will give us the SpaceNet report. That should take us to approximately 11 p.m., and I will return and tie a proverbial bow on everything and wish you well for the following week. So that's bad if everything works on my end and the repeater's end. So with that in mind, we're open for questions or comments. Anyone want to get on the list, just hit that push to talk and your first name and your call sign.
Interaction at regular
interest. Wes recognized. Anyone else out there want to put their name on the list for tonight? Gosh, 3 weeks in a row, like, gosh. Once again, we'll give you another try. Of course, as progresses, hopefully, there'll be other people who have questions or comments or topics for discussion. But before we go on with what we got, anyone that want to put their name down the list?
KB2 Delta Alpha Bravo, Dave, Manhattan.
Okay, people double.
KB2 SHO.
Okay, John recognized. Let me put your name down, John. Okay, some other people doubled with each other. You want to try again?
Whiskey 2, Delta Alpha Bravo. Dave, Matt.
KD2VHD. Okay, so we got Wes, who doesn't have a ham-related question. We have John, KC2SHO. We have Dave, and we have Jim. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight?
AE2DB. AE2DB.
Yes, what's your first name, sir?
Name is Joe.
Okay, well, we'll start at the top of the list, except that Wes mentioned not a ham-related question. We'll put you on a little bit later after we go through the ham questions. John, what's your question or your comment for tonight?
Was that directed at me, Roy? KC2SHO.
Yes, that was you. It is unusual tonight, one of those nights where we don't have any other John tonight. We have a Jim, we have a Joe, but we have no other John. So it's you, KC2SHO.
Yeah, that is a bit weird, and for one of the first times in my life, I'm in a group of people at work where there are no other Johns, so my nickname of Jay-Z is not as it usually is, but it's catching on, I digress. My question is, and it's something I thought about, something I've never really looked into, when you get a 6-meter opening, is it always progressive? In other words, do you see, 17 meters opening up, then 10 meters, or then 12, then 10 meters, and then 6 meters? Or can it be more random than that? Can you have this kind of sporadic 6-meter opening while the other bands and the maximum usable frequency are much lower? Does that question make sense? AC2GSKC2SHO.
Okay, John. Well, it makes sense. It's a good question. I don't have a lot of experience with 6 meters generally. My gut feeling, and I'm open to people correcting me if my gut feeling is completely wrong, is that although you would think that you just kind of go up the frequencies as F1, F2 got energized, I don't think so. The ionosphere is such a turbulent object, capable of all kinds of erratic function, that I am willing to bet anything that there are days where one of the high end of the HF bands are open and the others are closed. Particular areas of a particular band are open and the others are closed. And because a lot of times, a lot of these propagations are highly localized. I've told this story before on 10-meter nets, that all of a sudden a relatively middle-sized town in Nebraska opened up, and I spoke to about 5 unrelated contacts in that town just because we seemed to have a duct open at the time. So my gut feeling would be that it's not a uniform thing. It's very erratic and unpredictable. But again, I'm open for correction. If there are people out there that have a better understanding and would like to share it, please do.
WA2VDH with a comment.
Yes, VDH.
Hi, WA2VDH, handler's John. Yes, from my long-ago operating days on 6 meters back in the late 60s with my old Viking Challenger, I remember the characteristics were, as you mentioned, were sporadic E, which were essentially patches of ionized upper atmosphere. It wasn't like it was a continuous area, so you would get like propagation on 6 meters out to a particular area like the Midwest, because the sporadic E cloud provided propagation reflection to that area of the country. As far as in the lower bands, I didn't see any significant change or increase. I mean, the lower frequencies were active, but I always remember checking channel 2 for on the TV for 6 meter activity when channel 2 was showing other channel 2 stations skipping in. I knew that 6 meters were also active, but yeah, it was more of a sporadic cloud, sporadic E cloud type of propagation. Go ahead.
Okay, thanks, John. I appreciate it. I always like to use the analogy, and they're all imprecise, but I use the analogy of the ionosphere as being currents of a river, like fluid of ionized gases just kind of circulating at different. This is above us, you know, the 1F2 layer has a specific range of distances above the ground. So that's I like to do it. But, yeah, it's not a very predictable thing. A lot of times you'll pick a book on ionosphere and propagation, and they'll have this lovely drawing of basically an eggshell with legends saying F1, 2, D, E, and what have you. But it's more like a turbulent river than eggshells or in my mind a cloud, but whatever analogy works for you. So yeah, I would we kind of agree that it's not a one of those things you can depend upon. Like most things in amateur radio, there's a lot of variable aspects in propagation and ionosphere and such. Anyone else with any comments about how early propagation is on the higher HF bands? Okay, John, I guess that's about all she wrote. I'll be looking up things in Google and see if I could come up with anything other than what I gave you tonight, and if I find something interesting, I'll mention it next Sunday night. But, like I said, I think one of the positives of this hobby in a weird way is the fact that it's so unpredictable that you never quite know what you got until you turn the radio on and rotate that phone knob.
Yeah, real good, Roy. It's been something I've been thinking about. I only dabble in HF here and there whenever I have time. And in the summer months, the shack is a little warm to keep everything on all the time. But I want to try to be able to figure out when are the best times to try to find some 6-meter activity VHF, which is something I think I'm more interested in than all of the others, if that makes any sense. Anyway, thank you for the comments, and I will also look deeper into this subject. It was something that's been on my mind, but I not found time to really do much searching on, so always fun to put that question out to the hive mind and the smart people that hang around nets like this. AC2GSKC2SHO, I'll be listening here.
Okay, very good, John. Thank you for participating. As always, we look forward to your questions. They're always something that I haven't thought of prior to your asking them. So I thank you very much. Next on our list is Dave. Dave, what's your question or comment or topic for tonight? Okay, if there's someone trying to transmit to the repeater, try and either raise your power or do something with your antenna because you are 100% noise. There's no audio at all that I can perceive.
Yeah, this is Whiskey 2 Delta Alpha Bravo, Dave. I had a question if anyone had heard of or played with Meshtastic. It's a 915 megahertz technology. It's not strictly ham radio. It's a small device like the LilyGo Beam. It's a text. It's a mesh of text-based communication. I'm wondering if anyone out there has played with it or had any comments on it.
Okay, Dave, that's a good question. We'll open for any comments. Meshtastic, I've read a bunch about it. I think it's more popular on the West Coast where the amateur radio density is higher, and the problem with things like it's basically a pseudo Wi-Fi mesh packet type of radio situation. The benefit is that, you know, if one part of the mesh goes down, it's self-healing, but it requires a significant density of transceivers within the mesh to really be functional. So, you know, if you only have a couple of people interested, it's a lot more difficult to develop a good network using mesh casting. I haven't used it myself. Again, I've read a bunch of things about it. West Coast, usually it's from articles of guys on the West Coast. Yeah, I think you got to kind of reach a certain density, and there's a lot of hams, apparently, on the West Coast. If you look at the incremental call sites, I mean, they're almost down to AZ6s. So if anyone out there had any personal practical experience with mesh tasking and would like to share it with us, please hit that push to talk. Yeah, I was kind of afraid of that. Don't know what to tell you, Dave. I know the club has experimented with somewhat similar technologies. They've used SDR dongles and interconnected them through the Internet to provide a kind of mesh network of people, you know, signal strengths of people transmitting to our repeaters. But that was a kind of, that wasn't really considered, I don't think, a mesh-tastic type of a thing, but somewhat similar technologies. But again, we'll try one more time. Anyone out there who's had any practical experience with mesh-tastic, please hit that push to talk and share. Yeah, once again, sorry, Dave. Are you considering kind of playing around with it? And again, my understanding is that, you know, it takes more than one for something like that.
Yes, I have a unit, and it's interesting. I set it up, you know, using some videos from YouTube and that kind of thing. And you know, I'm on the east side of Manhattan, facing, you know, Queens and Long Island. And I look out, and I actually had two mesh networks pop up in Astoria, which is right across the way. But then they promptly tried. I tried to connect or try to figure out who they were to try to connect, but never did have any luck. And then they sort of promptly disappeared, as if to go under the radar. But it's interesting. It wasn't that much of an investment, and I don't know, it sort of held some promise that it could be a good low-power, you know, alternate communication device that's encrypted, create your own, you know, channel, so to speak, and you send out people, a QR code, and they can join people that you want to trust to join your network. So it has some promise, but like you said, you need a certain density. So I've been interested in Packet and that kind of thing for a long time. Used to be able to hit the LineMark board several years ago with Packet and enjoyed that. So it's just something I enjoy. Okay, back to you, AC2GS. Thank you so much for the effort.
You're welcome, Dave. Is your radio Lyra based, or is it using another type of protocol?
Yes, it is LoRa-based, 915 megahertz, so, you know, I know the range isn't that great, but, you know, I've talked to a few people, actually. I do some volunteer work for the Coast Guard Auxiliary, and I met another guy who's very interested in it, and he's sort of up by 91st Street, I'm at 75th, so we're going to try to connect, but I'll keep you posted in the future, perhaps. Back to you.
AC2GS. Yeah, I've seen a couple of interesting YouTubes on, you know, how to kind of quickly build your own transceiver and send encrypted messages back and forth to friends. It kind of goes against the concept of amateur radio. That's why it operates on one of the open frequencies, not amateur radio related. Because as we all know, the FCC requires that all amateur radio transmissions be inherently unencrypted. If it has a kind of a simple algorithm, it needs to be published so that you can't send secret messages on the amateur radio band. But I wish you good luck, Dave, and if you discover anything interesting and you want to share, we're always here. Okay, I guess we'll move on to KD2VHV. Do you have any questions or comments for tonight, Jim?
I had a question for the ether. It was interesting you mentioned the D-Day anniversary, and I was wondering if anybody wanted to basically field a trivia question of what beachhead was General George Patton leading on the D-Day invasion day. It's an interesting conversation. Over to that.
Okay. I don't know the answer. Trivia. I don't know. I never really got into it. Anyone out there want to tell Jim their thoughts on where Patton is?
K-E-2-H-A-U. I'm Charlie.
Yes, indeed, Charlie. Would you like to take Jim up on that puzzle?
Yes.
Okay, please do.
He was stuck in a hotel room.
Okay, care to expand upon that?
Butch S. Patton were being disciplined by Eisenhower about disturbing, smacking a kid in the field hospital, and they taught him some lessons about discipline.
Ah, very good. It's been a long time since I've seen the movie, the biography of Patton. Well, was that in the movie? Because I vaguely remember George C. Scott smacking some poor actor in it.
Yes. There were a lot of people who did not like Patton, the higher up. And Eisenhower and him had a major falling out, and Eisenhower later on never went to Patton's funeral, and that was another problem.
Okay, well, just because fellow generals don't particularly mean they get along with each other, unfortunately. It takes a certain type of an ego to make it to general. So I can sort of understand where, they're not the most diplomatic group of people in the world. So I assume that that's what you were looking for, Jim, was it?
Well, that's part of the story, but it doesn't really get at the heart that I was wondering if anybody would pick up on.
Okay, so Charlie, do you think you could expand as far as Jim would prefer?
George S. Patton did not come ashore until, I think, day 3 or day 4, and I believe he was north of Omaha Beach, which was the beach that was on the extreme right.
Okay, Jim, if Charlie isn't addressing what you're expecting, maybe you should share it with us. Again, it was 80 years ago, and we're not all military kind of historians out there.
Well, it certainly is a military question, but it's not guns and knives and stuff. All those things that were stated definitely were part of the story. But Patton was in charge of what was called the Third Army at the time, which in effect it consisted of inflatable tanks and recorded noises and radio transmissions to make it look like there was a landing force to go to a certain place. And he was used as a complete diversion, so the Germans were ready for his attack, which did not happen. It was a big pile of dismiss and malinformation that was imperative to the D-Day success. It's a very interesting story worth learning about.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I remember reading about how they put in a lot of effort to give false information and totally have the Nazis looking in the wrong place at the wrong time. And it was very effective. I mean, You know, unfortunately, it's not that easy to keep a secret, especially when there's a lot of people involved. My understanding also was a lot of the people involved D-Day didn't particularly know any of the details until the very instant that they needed to know those details. So it's an interesting example of the Army doing something that worked incredibly well. And a good thing, too, the last week or so, there's been a lot of conversation of talking heads on cable and radio and YouTube and such of, what would have happened if D-Day had failed. And there's a lot of pessimistic people out there that were winding stories up that Germany might have either completely won or sued for peace and partially won, and it would have changed the entire face of Europe, and England would be more powerful, and the United States would be less powerful, and all kinds of interesting, belly button gazing going on. So, it's a good thing our side won, obviously, or otherwise, who knows, I probably wouldn't be sitting here talking on the radio. Anyway, any other comments, Jim?
No, yes, it was definitely an important piece of history. Thanks for engaging the thought. K2VHD, back to that.
Okay, very good, Jim. Next on my list is Joe, K2DBE. What's your question or your comment for tonight, Joe?
My question is around antennas and how they actually work. I've been spending a little bit of time thinking about, is it that the antenna, when it's connected to a device, is attracting the radio waves, or are the waves simply always out there and it's just picking up what's already close by, if that makes sense?
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, it's complicated and it's a little bit of both. But ultimately, what's going on is electromagnetic waves are all over the place, as you might realize, that the entire spectrum is pretty much active to one magnitude or another, and it's going around you, it's going somewhat through you, it's all over the place. When it gets to a piece of conducting material which is resonant, it sets up a alternating current on the antenna, on the conductor that is the antenna. Now, if it's not connected to a load of a receiver, the current doesn't go any place. It's just kind of a local current that just standing waves of just kind of dissipates back into thermal waste heat. If, on the other hand, you connect that antenna to a receiver's front end, it current will travel down the transmission line into the RF amplifier and then different stages, and ultimately that microwatt of energy is amplified by an audio amplifier, and you hear the message on the other end. So it interacts with antenna, but if it has no place to go, if it's not grounded or it's not connected to some kind of load, the current doesn't really go very far. It just kind of sits there and wastes away as a small amount of waste heat.
Yep, that makes sense. That answers the question. I kind of put myself in a thought loop thinking about it. But it does make sense what you're saying, and I do recall in the material that the loss does become heat, so then it does go somewhere, just the way it's heat. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. And you kind of were addressing the question purely related, as receiving. There's an interesting flip aspect that happens in transmitting. When you transmit off of your antenna, there's something called the near field and there's something called the far field. And the distance for the near field is at the antenna and maybe plus or minus a little bit, a wavelength or so away from your antenna. And the near field and the far field have interesting different characteristics. If you go to the far field, if you have some kind of power meter set up for your transmitter to see how much energy is being used in your transmitter, and you go into the far field and you set up 1,000 different antennas, you will notice no change in the power rating output of your transmitter. If you take those antennas and you put them within the near field, though, because the more antennas in the near field, the more power is drawn from the transmitter. So I find that always a kind of a curious, weird thing that goes on. It's a total near-field phenomena. Once you get into the far field, you could have an infinite number of receivers, and it won't change the power output of your transmitter.
Oh, boy. That's even more food for thought now. Thank you, though.
You're welcome. I thought it was an interesting concept, and it's always, you know, it's always nice to have something kind of bouncing around in your head that you try and make sense of. There's a lot of interesting, weird things that go on in the near field. The nature of the electro and the magnetic fields have a time difference. Electromagnetic waves in the far field are synchronized. So when the electric field is at its maximum, the magnetic and the electric field both are at maximum at the same time. Whereas a lot of the electromagnetic waves going on in the near field are 90 degrees out of whack. So when one is high, the other one's zero, and vice versa. So the near field and the far field is a fascinating field of a subject. So if you ever have nothing better to do, you know, either Google it or type it into a YouTube video, and it doesn't require a great deal of math. A lot of it is a nice illustration. So keep that in mind.
Again, it's all very interesting. I guess that's why we all like the hobby. Back to you.
Okay, very good. Thanks for participating. If you have any further questions down the road, you know where to find us. So thanks again. So next on our list is Wesley. What you got for us tonight, Wesley?
Thank you very much. First, I have a question to the last subject that you discussed, the far field, more than 10 wavelengths away from the antenna, the one where the power components of the field dominate between the propagating electromagnetic plane wave, and those components are indeed in phase with each other, but it's 10 wavelengths.
Well, I mean, if you look at the definition of the field, usually by two wavelengths, they'll describe that as the far field. And one of the primary weirdnesses, other than what I've already mentioned about near field, is because the electric and magnetic fields are not always in sync, the attenuation of near field magnetic electromagnetic waves is much faster. So a lot of the non-synchronized electromagnetic waves dissipate and either are transformed into aligned electromagnetic fields or just dissipate as heat again. So it depends what we're really chatting about. I wasn't really chatting because most people, when they discuss near-field phenomena, they're dealing with other kinds of weirdness. There's a lot of strange things that go on. In the near field, sometimes we'll call it the transformer field because it's the type of field that is that makes transformers work. You know, no transformer I'm aware of operates long enough to be defined as the far field. It's all near field phenomena. So you could also use transformer field as a synonym for that.
PhD question?
Yes, Jim.
Can you define near field and far field? Is there a particular, you know, distance number or concept that splits them apart?
Okay. The problem is that it's not a binary, so it doesn't go from 0 to 1 at an exact length. So it's kind of vague. It starts out very, very weird with a lot of orthogonally synchronized electromagnetic waves with weird characteristics. And as you get past about 1.5 wavelengths, most of it dissipates and you're left with the same type of radiation that you see in the very, very far field. So the range for a changeover from a near-field phenomena to a far-field phenomena takes place someplace between, say, 1.5 wavelengths to 2 wavelengths. But, you know, it's a gradual transition as opposed to an abrupt snapping of from one mode to another.
W2EAV.
Yes, Ed.
I have some experience with near field and far field, and I have some thoughts if you want to hear me pontificate.
I would love to hear you pontificate, Ed.
For wireless communication, the near field is a joke. If you are within a couple of wavelengths from the transmitter to the receiver, you're using the wrong medium. You might just be able to yell at each other. Where it really becomes important is when you're doing antenna patterns on an antenna range. In order to do proper antenna patterns, you have to be out in the field, which means antenna ranges must be very large. I've worked on antenna ranges that are dozens and dozens of acres in order to get the far field, and land is expensive. Recent years, they've been trying to use computer corrections to allow you to use smaller antenna ranges and use the near field to take the antenna patterns. I kind of lost touch on that a number of years ago, but I think they were starting to make progress.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that they had progressed in that way. Yeah, again, near field is, to me, fascinating. But it's not exactly the same in any way, shape, or form as far field. Matter of fact, one of the questions that I used to kind of ask Dick, and Dick would, you know, there's no real answer as far as I'm aware, is you know, how you get from a near-field orthogonal electromagnetic field to a synchronized one in the far field. I think I've mentioned before, I went to the trouble of buying some guy's PhD thesis on the subject where he posits a solution. So, you know, if you can get a PhD thesis of it and not get an award from it, it's kind of indicative of how complicated the situation is about the near field. But, yeah, I tend to find it fascinating, personally. But I wasn't aware that they had been able to better model near field effects and correlate them with field effects to give you kind of decent information. That's another thing I got to look up, I guess.
Another comment?
Certainly.
Yeah, like I said, as of about 8 or 9 years ago, it looked like they were making progress, but then I lost track of how the antenna range is doing these days. But here is the point. If you really want to get down to the nitty-gritty of it, if you want to read a PhD paper, I am sure that it involves huge amounts of incredibly complicated mathematics, where the equations go across the page multiple times. Most of the symbols, you need another graduate degree in engineering to just know what the symbols are, not to do the actual math.
Well, you know, I mean, I went to the end of the book and to the summary and such. This guy's theory tends to involve temporal things going on, like the time frame for the electromagnetic waves somehow changes over the distance from the near field to the far field. You know, he kind of also had some theories about how the curl factor kind of displaces it in space and time. And it were interesting things. I didn't expect to totally understand a guy's PhD thesis. That's why the people who grade guys who write PhD theses have PhDs in physics. So I didn't really expect to have a full understanding. I just wanted to have a vague understanding. You know, sometimes you can get a vague understanding of things that are based in sophisticated mathematics. Not in this case.
Well, I dabbled in it, but didn't go anywhere near that level. And that alone was akin to being tortured.
Well, yeah, I mean, it sort of depends upon how deep you go. If you keep it somewhat superficial, then I have found that that's the best way to not get a migraine. Once upon a time, I found a free college-level electrical engineering book on antenna theory, and I think I got through about a page and a half, and I developed a nosebleed. So I stick with antenna books that are designed for amateur radio operators. There's a United Kingdom antenna book. There's, of course, the ARRL antenna book, and there's a German antenna book that's translated into the English. And thankfully, they spare me the matrix math.
By the way, Roy, the standard test for many, many years on antennas, not the ARL version, the real version where they really throw the math at you, is called Krauss. And that is definitely a graduate level test.
Yeah, that's the one that gave me the nosebleed.
As said on many before.
Okay, I'm glad to have friends with it. Well, I mean, I can remember years ago, hey, rest in peace, discussing how matrix math was not something he looked forward to. And I think he mentioned that he used to interview people who were going for employment where he worked. And one candidate said that they liked the matrix math, and he didn't kind of understand that from the story that he told everyone here.
I'm sure there are some outliers that love that sort of stuff. I have personally met people who love math. I mean, they're not only engineering, but they seem to love the math more than the engineering, where to me, the math is a tool to help you learn the engineering. But math for its own sake, I have no love.
Yeah, AC2GS, by the way. I think it takes a particular mind to wrap itself around higher mathematics for mathematics' sake. All of the, college-type mathematicians, see it a beauty to the symmetry and to the way numbers work and operations work. And if there are people to talk with, I don't identify with them, but it's always interesting to see people coming to the world from a slightly different angle than myself. So, if anyone's seen, a Beautiful Mind, it gives you a very, very, very superficial take into, what mathematicians tend to be like. Not that all kind of schizophrenic, but they're working on a different level of the universe than we are.
I would be leery about taking that literally, because that is so oversimplified. You have to lose something.
Well, most things are oversimplified to one degree or another. So, I tend to just put a very big plus or minus error value on it. Take it from, as far as it can go. It's just my personal take on these things. I've known guys who were into higher math, and they're somewhat similar to guys who kind of do a lot of machine language, assembly language coding. Not the same exactly, but kind of kissing cousins.
Lot of assembly language, and I find it very, very user-friendly.
Oh, okay. Well, different strokes for different folks. I mean, I've played around with little teeny bits that in the good old days you could kind of insert some assembly language into very time-sensitive loops within larger programs, but I don't think I've ever gone anything past that. Someone was throwing out their call sign. Can you do it again, please?
K2GJE.
Ah, okay. What do you got for us?
I want to know, in spite of the in the square law, how come we're still talking to each other over?
Well, this gives you a radio. It doesn't limit your ability to get from point A to point B.
Are we going to pass the loss calculation?
Personally, I hope not.
I've gotten stuck in them.
Yeah, I mean, suffice it to say, we're able to communicate with each other. You know, I don't know exactly what the benefit of trying to figure out why we aren't not talking to each other, which I know is a double negative, and I know you hate double negatives, Ed.
Oh, comment?
Certainly.
You mentioned Krause's book before. I think he was a ham radio operator, wasn't he?
I think he was, but I don't know his call sign offhand. I mean, Dick used to mention him regularly. So when I found the PF on the internet, I said, I got to look at this one. And like I said, about 20 minutes later and a cotton ball later, I had decided that matrix math, you know, I mean, I've taken calculus, I took quantum mechanics. Matrix math is not any of those things. So I figured that there are places where it's probably for me not to enter.
Yeah, I know those divergence and curls and all those operators, they will give you a real nosebleed. I know the feeling well.
No. Curl is not matrix math. I had curl in my second or third year of engineering school.
And I got an
curl. Yeah, I don't have any problem with curl because Faraday's laws and all those things, the equations kind of require you to know what curl is. Curl doesn't really give me that much of a problem. I mean, that's really vector math. That's just not really matrix math.
Hang on. For those who are just what in the name of God we're talking about, but the curl is you take three dimensions, split it up into the x, y, and z axes, and you do necessary math, which usually involves, you know, equals and stuff like that, the three dimensions, and you recombine them into a composite result, and then you pull your hair out.
And do numerical coordinates.
You choose your coordinate system. But you pull your hair out no matter which coordinate system you're using.
Well, like anything, there are introductory YouTubes where they have very nice illustrations of what curl is in three-dimensional space-time. You don't necessarily have to use it to solve equations. And I would ask, unless you need to do it, you shouldn't do it. But the fundamental concept of what a curl sort of is can still be interesting and can be represented by a graphic without any kind of sophisticated mathematics required, just for the initial, oh, that's what that is.
A comment?
Certainly.
It all became pretty clear to me when I, after my electromag course, which Muddy Waters, and I had a fluid mechanics course, and they used same operators, and then it all made sense. I was able to put a handle on it, or at least get a kind of a definition of actually what was going on, what was being calculated. But in the middle of the E&M course, it was a mystery. Just transferred RCA Institutes into CCNY, and that was one of the first courses they hit us with. And it was a total mystery.
A couple of questions. When did you have fluid mechanics at CCNY?
This is going back, let's see. I was there in 1968. I transferred from RCA Institute to CCNY, so that was about 1970 when I had that fluid mechanics course. CE-120 was the... It was given by the civil engineering department, but it was an elective for double E courses. Go ahead.
Yeah, three years ahead of you. And I had a teacher was a Hien graduate student. I'm not talking Donyatu or something. He was a very good teacher, thick accent, but the name was almost unpronounceable. Any chance you had him? I'm trying to remember now. Let's see. I remember in the electrical department there was a Professor O. I had him for the digital courses. Now, I remember it was an Asian instructor that I had for the fluid mechanics course, a CE-120. I don't remember his name, though. It's going back to too many years.
Well, the bottom line is, if you enter the fluid mechanics with the muddy waters, that is the course to deal with muddy waters. It's fluid mechanics.
Yep, that works.
Can I go on?
Yeah, just one second. Let me just throw in my little two cents. It's always nice people remember their teachers, because I think there's a lot of people who don't remember their teachers. There's usually good reasons or very bad reasons for that. And just about, I think it was 5 or 6 years ago, I don't know why, I looked up one of my old chemistry professors from NYU just to find out what happened. Usually that's very depressing, because I looked up my science teacher from high school. He had retired to Florida and passed away. And this old gentleman, I think he's about 88 years old, God bless him, and he still has recommendations on the NYU student site. He was a very corny comedian back when I knew him, back in around 75 or 76. And sure enough, the student notes on him was he was a good teacher, but he was a terrible corny comedian. So he hadn't changed in all those years. So I just wanted to throw out something about one of my old professors. One of my professors, I must have mentioned it at some point or another, anthropology professor, ended up dying in prison. He was a very, very insane person. He had his graduate students making koalas in the lab, and he was arrested, and finally he was paroled, and he decided he was going to poison everyone who got him into jail, and then he was rearrested until he passed away. So, like I said, there are good reasons to remember our teachers, and there are very bad reasons to remember our teachers. So, with all that in mind, yes, back to you, Wesley. We got distracted.
No problem at all. Well, infinitesimal circulation of vector field in tri-dimensional Euclidean space, known as with use of the curls, may be fascinating. But I wanted to discuss something else today. In May 27, I have sent you email that was titled "Try to go in airport with that and see what happens." Do you recall that video?
Yeah, I do vaguely, but oh, I mean, time passes rather quickly. So other than that strange thing showed, I don't really remember anything much about it.
Yeah, it was a strange device that looked like underwater bomb used to blow any kind of ship that appears to touch it. But it's rather smaller than this one, and it is actually used for different purposes. It is called Banshee 343. It is ultrasonic gas leak detector. But when you look at it, yes, it looks like that underwater bomb. Back to you.
Okay, I think there's a lot of things that would scare airport attendants if they saw it. I vaguely remember when new technology first developed. You know, these people are the last to know, and so they get a little bit scared of anything that they see. So I mean, and that particular device did look rather scary. It almost looked like a landmine or some such. So, you know, but there's a lot of things that look scarier than they actually are.
Okay, so it has the a spherical shape, and it has an outstanding cylindrical probe that looks like the the explosive triggering devices, but actually the advanced leak detection system utilizing four ultra-sensitive acoustic sensors, which constantly monitor wide areas for ultrasound generated from the release of pressurized gas. The reason that I decided to send it to you is that they used ultrasonics for gas leaking applications. So what they say is that it has been engineered to withstand even most extreme conditions and is not affected by inclement weather with wind direction or leak direction or any potential gas dilution with an instantaneous response to all of the gas types. So it looks like it really doesn't have a gas detector. It reacts to the sound of the pressurized pipe that is where the gas is leaking from. Absolutely something that I never get across with. Back to you.
Okay, I would assume that the elected sound waves can be altered by the flow of escaping gas, and if you figure out the characteristics of that reflection, you can use it to detect leaking gas.
Actually, it's an advanced acoustic sensor that utilized the gas leak detection to protect plant or personnel, and it cost over $50,000. It is, I checked it, it is on eBay. It is on eBay for $5,999. It's a used one, it's not a new one. Oh no, it says new open box. Open box, okay. And there was the video from EEV blog. So that's the Australian guy who is making the videos, a pretty much talented guy with electronics. I was some time ago criticizing him, but guy is really good. Okay, so that was for the knowledge about the leak detection. Then prototyping, the rocket injectors. There was another video that I have sent you, and there was a clever guy who managed to have a small machining shop, but it's it is educated a guy in physics, and he's describing how NASA make combustion chambers and nozzle. So I would be glad if Paul is available right now. Paul?
Hi, Wes.
Yeah, so the one of the videos about the nozzle with the chalice in it and how they do it, did you have a chance to see it? And do you have a comment on it?
Yes, I thought it was great. You know, he really went into detail. But basically, he's trying to show is the difficulty that they had back in the 70s developing engines compared to what they could do today with 3D equipment. And they show that the idea of a rocket engine, of course, is to create thrust. One of the, you know, a couple of the parts get very hot, and that's the combustion chamber and the knot, you know, they all get very hot. Big cones sticking out of the bottom. So what they did years ago is run fine tube all over, you know, the nozzle and the combustion chamber. They soldered it, you know, it had the brazing, you know, they would run the cold cryogenic fluids through the nozzle before they would be burnt up in the combustion chamber to keep, you know, the idea is to keep that cool. Otherwise, you know, you're going to get 1,000 degrees. It's going to melt if you have
strong, very strong field. He's Nicola, what's his name? I think it's what it is. Let me